the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. Joining me is retired Air Force Major General David Jones, one of the pilots on one of the most daring feats in U.S. military history, the bombing of Japan by Doolittle's Raiders in April 1942. General Jones was the pilot of Crew No. 5 on that mission. After returning to the United States, he was reassigned to the 12th Air Force in North Africa, where he was shot down and spent 2.5 years in a Nazi prison camp. We began our conversation with his formative years and the early influences on his life.
I was born in early years in Oregon, and then when I was about 12 years old, I had an older sister, 10 years older. She was in nursing school at Berkeley and came down with tuberculosis, or consumption, we call it. And so my mother took me and my younger sister to Tucson. And so I grew up in Tucson, Grammar School, High School, and University of Arizona. In 1936, I went on active duty in the cavalry. I got out of school. I didn't have clues of what to do, but there was a Congressman Thomason from Texas got this law, rule passed, I guess it was. They took 1,000 reserve officers from all branches for a year's active duty, and then awarded 50 regular commissions at the end of the year. So I ended up in the cavalry, and I didn't get one of those commissions. But one of the West Pointers, my buddy, one day, "What are you doing?" He said, "He's going up to Beaumont Hospital to get a physical. I'm going to be a flyer." And I said, "Well, hell, I'll go with you," because I was about to be homeless and jobless. So I took a flight physical. And then I went back to my troop, cavalry troop, and the old first sergeant got out the books and typed. He took his little finger and he typed out everything I needed to do. And I ended up with my boots and spurs and campaign hat and went down and got sworn in as a flying cadet in 1937. So I got a flying school in 1938.
Well, little did you know at that time you would be 4 years later, did you?
No, that's right. So I was at March Field, and we opened McCord Field, Tacoma. And, of course, we're expanding slowly. And we were moving, and we were maneuvering the Air Force and the Army, everybody was. And, of course, then after December, by then, things had started to explode. And when I went through in 38, you had 8 months at Randolph and 4 months at Kelly, and that's it. And there was a total output in 1938 of about 250 pilots, period. So then they started building these schools, civilian schools, and pumping out cadets by the hundreds. So and then, of course, after Pearl Harbor, we again started. We're on maneuvers almost continually, and the airplane B-25s, we started picking them up, and they were cranking them out. Well, by the fall of Pearl Harbor, and the 17th group, hell, we are up to 50 or 60 airplanes. We're out in the field. And we went into California to start another maneuver with the Navy on the 7th, and that's when it hit the fan.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come to get selected for the mission?
Well, again, we were the 17th bomb group, and we were the first people, and actually the only unit equipped with the B-25. And they moved us around like you'd move your family from here to Chicago, you know, and they, we were in Pendleton, Oregon, and they said, you're moving to Carolina, which we did. And this Colonel Doolittle showed up and talked to the group commander and got us everybody together and said that they're coming up a secret mission that probably pretty dangerous, and you'd be over out of the country for several months, and it involves action against an enemy capital. Period. Who wants to go? And everybody raised their hand, including the group commander. And it turned out then that we had the three squadrons and the recce squadron, that they picked five crews from, so the 20 of us ended up as selected. It wasn't by lot, but just the squadron commander said, okay, you can go, or he's going. It was pretty simple.
Well, where did you go then for the training?
So we ended up then, the 20 of us, down at Eglin. And, of course, that's a big reservation. And we sort of, again, there were four of us who were pre-war regulars, lieutenants. We had one guy as a captain. So there were four. And most of the rest of the people were in the group, and they'd been with us maybe 6 months or a year. Most of them were late 40 or early 41 pilots out of the flying school. And so we worked pretty hard there for about a month.
Well, you're training because of the nature of the mission, the whole factor of shorter takeoff distance, weight factor when you took off, not much time to climb.
That's exactly.
Now, you must have had some sense that you were going to be taking off from someplace that was very different.
That's correct. When we got there about the next day sort of thing, Lieutenant Miller, from a Navy pilot from Pensacola, it was real close to Pensacola, came over, mm-hmm. and introduced himself, and he said he's here to help us. And a short field takeoff and Navy protocol, you know, customs and services and all that sort of stuff. Well, he'd never seen a twin engine airplane, and we didn't have know anything about a carrier. So amongst ourselves, two or three of us who were the old lieutenants went out to. At Eglin, big reservation, and at that point, they had about half a dozen or more 5,000-foot academy McAdam strips, and they're spread all over this big damn place. So we used that field, and two of us went out there and stretched our head, and at any rate, we evolved our takeoff procedure, and we just.
And, using about 10% of the
three of us, and we'll do it this way. And we ended up evolved our system. We went with full flaps and trim and everything, and then go to power, release the brake, and we run no more than 3 or 4 seconds, and back with the wheel. Clearing your belly, and the nose came up, and you'd push it forward and use your foot to hold it, and you sort of go like that and start to pick up power and everything fine.
So when did you learn where you were going?
It turned out he didn't tell us, and we didn't. And incidentally, wasn't around very much, the old man, because he was all over the countryside getting this thing organized and dealing with the Navy and visiting contractors to be sure that they were doing the right thing as far as modifications were concerned. So, but what he had said, action against an enemy capital that had not been bombed. Well, we all scratched our head a little bit. Well, Berlin was taking a beating from the British, and so it sort of, and then with the carrier bit, it became pretty obvious. Although no one, we theoretically didn't talk about it and didn't really know, but I didn't mention today that in February, not too long after we got there, a navigator and I, Tom Griffin and I, went to Washington, down here in the old federal building, an Army War Department building, was down in the on the mall. Hell, those are temporary buildings from World War One, and they secreted us in a little secret place, and we were getting target material and maps, and we were getting aviation maps, you know, 1 to 500,000 maps and charts, and we got French maps and English and French and German and Chinese or Jap. We had four or five issues, and Tom Griffin and I, and we just had looked at them and try to decide which one we want to take with us, type of business. And we found this, that along the coast, they're all, everyone's the same. Everybody had the harbors and the and outlines, and the whole bit were pretty, obviously, pretty accurate. As you went inland, and in planning, we knew on the targets by that time in Japan, or we did, and then the recovery in eastern China, and then on to Chongqing.
We'll continue our visit with General David Jones after these messages.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. My guest this week is retired Air Force Major General David Jones, one of the pilots of the famed Doolittle Raiders of World War II. As the carrier task force containing the 16 B-25 steamed across the Pacific toward the Japanese mainland, he and his fellow crewmen continued their preparations.
On the boat, of course, we took up the whole deck on transit. When they got ready to move, they stacked us all in the back, obviously hanging over the edge and so on. And we had to be clear to the island because they didn't want us to take off behind short of the island because the wing might catch the island, and that wouldn't be a very good thing. Mm-hmm. So we were adjacent to the island, about halfway up the island, and they spotted the old man. And then after he took off, then they moved each of us individually up to that spot so that we had about 380 feet, which was more than ample. It turned out the simplest. In fact, we modified our procedure after the old man got off. The task force, we had the two carriers, four cruisers, eight destroyers, two oilers. In the last 24 hours, the two carriers and the four cruisers, we went faster, and everybody else stayed behind. They couldn't keep up with us in the heavy. And the water was, sea was fairly heavy, and but we the carriers probably making in the weather at least 20 knots, maybe 25 knots, and we reckon we had at least 20 knots of wind, and so we only had to make up 30 miles an hour, 35 miles an hour, and we had 300 feet, so that was basically, you know what.
So yeah. These B-25s are loaded onto the Hornet, and they're just stationary until the actual moment the mission begins. So they load it on, and they're never expected to return.
Oh, no. That's exactly right. That's right. As I said, they were spread out. They covered the whole deck. And then the last day, they moved us back, packed us in the back end. No, that's exactly right.
How long did you steam before the takeoffs began?
Well,
where did you leave from?
It was at daybreak, or just before daybreak, when this picket ship was discovered by a scout airplane from the Enterprise, the other carrier. Right.
And how long had you been at sea?
Oh, 18 days.
18 days,
yeah.
Okay.
We left San Francisco on the first day of April, I think that's what it was. And as we went under the bridge, Golden Gate Bridge that morning, the captain came on the horn and said, "This task force is bound for Tokyo." Well, that's all hell broke loose. that's the first official time that all of us, and all the Navy, all the sailors, they didn't have the vaguest idea. I mean, they probably thought they were, the airplanes were all loaded on the damn carrier. And after they loaded us, we went out in the harbor, San Francisco Bay, and they anchored and said, "All ashore, going ashore." So we all got on a boat, went ashore, went up the top of the mark, and got snorkeled, and you could look out and see all these damn airplanes on this carrier, and we were all we were horrified. Everybody else thought, well, they're just ferrying us to Honolulu or someplace. So anyway, it was on the first of, we went over the boat, and it's all, then they were all friends. The Navy guys were all, we were all buddies then, and that was great. In fact, we had the pilots trying to talk their way into the airplane, you know, offering money to trade. That's a literal fact. But nothing ever happened.
So, which plane were you in? What number?
Five.
Number five.
I will say that we were organized by flights. And in theory, the first plan was that the old man would take off first at about noon, something like that. Maybe it was a little later than that. And he was loaded with incendiaries. We had bombs, either general purpose bombs, HEs, or incendiary cluster, the same way. And he was going to go be first in Tokyo with incendiaries. And in theory, then we were coming along later, and we could, incendiaries results would be helpful to us, guides. Well, and so we were organized by flights. So the first flight, number 2, 3, and 4, were on the north part of the city. Second flight was 5, 6 was me. The second flight and our targets were along the waterfront, and so on down the line. And then the last three guys, one at a time, one airplane each at Kobe and Osaka and wherever the other city was. That's three of them. Well. We get there at dusk and dark, and then we'd proceed And we get to China, there at daybreak, refuel, go to Chongqing. It's just as simple as that.
When we return, General Jones describes the bombing run over Japan, bailing out of his plane over China, and the rescue of his crew. This is Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezhen area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest place.
Cheer for Harlem operate.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, talking this week with retired Air Force Major General David Jones, one of the pilots of the famed Doolittle Raiders of World War II. Of the 16 B-25 bombers that left the deck of the carrier Hornet on April 18, 1942, 15 of the crews were forced to bail out or ditch their planes. One crew landed in Russia. General Jones piloted the fifth crew on the mission over Japan.
The way the airplane is set up, you have a people in the front, and then the bomb bay is just a little space about this big between the front and the back. And we had an engineer gunner in the back end. And old Sergeant Maskey, well, he's, what, 18 years old? 19, I guess. He's an old guy. He called up, he said, "Sir, we don't have enough gas." I said, "That's right." Right, that was the end of the story. You know, after the target and we're withdrawing, we're on the southwest course, and the navigator's taking sun lines almost continuously. And he called up, I don't know, X hours away. He said, "Hell, I don't think we got about 100 miles to swim. And we're, you know, we're in good shape." And by the time we got to the southern tip of Kyushu, we had picked up this tailwind of at least 40 knots for a good several hours, literally. And by the time we got to the southern tip of Kyushu, turning west, we got enough juice to get it. We knew that. Mm-hmm. We knew we had enough to get to land.
So where did you land?
By the time we're getting late in the day, and you realize we're getting close, you could tell by the water, we're getting close to land. We planned to go to the city of, to help make things help with the Chinese, new Chinese, who changed all the names, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this was called Chuchao in the Chekiang province, south of Ningpo Bay, which is not too far from Shanghai, was our destination. And an airfield there, and there they have a homing a communication and the beacon, although we didn't have any. All we had was a receiver. We had no transmitter. They took everything out. Anyway, zero. It wasn't there. Nothing. And said, "The reason we had all this wind is with bad damn weather." And we all pulled up. No, I didn't know. In my case, we pulled up to, 6,000 feet. And he flew, they ran out of gas and jumped out. But it turned out that we didn't have any homing and no lights on the ground. In fact, we were so early that any help that we might have had, they thought we were Japanese. So we were completely black, blind. Most of the airplanes, like the old man and me, except most guys, he flew till he ran out of juice and he jumped out. A couple of guys, one guy tried to land on the beach, put his gear down, and one guy died, but they got out. I guess two of them landed in the ocean. And two of them went, the Japanese had most of the coast and pockets inland around the big lakes and that sort of stuff. And two of the airplanes went so far inland when they bailed out, the Japs picked them up. And those are the two crews that were picked up.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, I missed it pretty close, 30-40 miles from destination.
So with whom did you first make contact who did come to help?
Well, I got to make a little funny here. The dark and stormy night, and I land on the windside and hillside, and it's windy and cold and all that sort of good stuff. And in the morning, I started walking west, and I found a trail, and I heard voices. And I got a cowbell is what it was. And then on this trail here, I approached five or eight people, peasants, farmers, I guess. And they had told us that on the boat that if you see a Chinaman, he's going to smile at a Jap, you don't know whether he's going to smile or not, type thing. Well, we grinned like hell, and I had, Jack and I had saved cigarettes. So I'm out with this, approached these guys and offered cigarettes, and they all took a cigarette. And I'm saying Yu Shan and town, and they didn't know anything. But old Jan, this big foreigner was pretty smart. See, and I'm out with my little spiral notebook, and I drew a map. So, well, guys, the poor guy, they had never heard of a map or knew what a map was. But I'm not through yet. I drew a picture of a locomotive with a little and smoke, you know. And I went choo 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 up and down the fat. Hell, I got a good hand. Hell, everybody'd smile. That obviously not help. Anyway, with that about an hour and a half, I found a railroad and went up the railroad, a small station. And my co-pilot showed up, and this station keeper, just one kid, he had a little hand car. I got in a hand car, and he pumped us up the track about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles, 5 miles, to another siding, and there was a freight car, an engine, with about 20, 30 soldiers. And they're Chinese, luckily. So we all got on the damn train, and obviously they had communicated, and everything is fine. And we went about 15 miles. Came to a big town, I think it's called Yushan, or was. And aside, there were several tracks, pretty good size rail station. Like, and it, things stopped, and we're standing in the open doorway of the freight car, and the tracks and the empty space, and a big crowd of people. You could see, I mean, like thousands. And a solitary figure walked across to the train in Western clothes, suit, coat, and he stopped and looked up at us. He says, "Hi, I'm Danny Yang. I'm the mayor of Yushan. And the troops are here to welcome you, our heroes who struck a blow for our freedom."
And heroes they were, and heroes they have remained ever since. The Doolittle Raiders of World War II. Thanks to General David Jones for sharing his memories of that historic event. And now a special bonus on this week's program, a conversation with one of the oldest living American veterans, Frank Buckle, a veteran of World War I. My colleague Greg Columbus had the honor of sitting with him briefly at this year's Memorial Day parade here in Washington.
Frank Buckles is 106 years old and is one of only three living World War I veterans known about by the U.S. government. In addition, he's the only one of those three who was in Europe during the war, which ended in November of 1918. Before making the trip to Washington to serve as an honorary marshal in the parade, Mr. Buckle spent a few minutes at his West Virginia farm speaking with me about his remarkable life. Frank Buckles was born in February of 1901. The 20th century was just dawning. William McKinley was president. His life began in the heartland of America, which gives him something in common with his hero, who was also commander of American forces in the First World War.
On my father's farm, north of Bethany, in Harrison County, Missouri. And when I met General John Joseph Pershing, he asked me, where was I born? When I told him, he said, just 43 miles as a crow flies from Linn County, where I was born. So we were fellow Missourians.
When Buckles was 13, World War I broke out in Europe. We may be able to watch war play out minute by minute today, but back then, of course, there was no television or radio to help him follow events. Nonetheless, Mr. Buckles was engrossed by the war coverage in his local newspaper.
Papers were all full of the events of the war. I could read about what was happening in Europe, the war we had in Mexico, right up to date.
As the next couple of years played out, Americans were drawn ever closer to the side of the Allies after German U-boats sunk the Lusitania and unrestricted submarine warfare threatened many passenger vessels in the Atlantic. Finally, in 1917, after learning of a German attempt to draw Mexico into war with our country, the United States declared war on Germany. Unlike some members of future generations who worked feverishly to avoid serving in wartime, to Buckles, the decision was an easy one.
Well, why wasn't it important? It was a world event, something I was interested in. Everybody was talking about it.
At age 16, Buckles tried to enlist, but was turned away by several recruiters for being underage. Since pretending to be 18 years old wasn't working, he told the next recruiter he was 21, and his military service officially got started.
I enlisted in the regular army on the 14th of August, 1917. I had been advised by one of the older sergeants that the way to get to France quickly was to go into the ambulance corps, because the French were begging for ambulance service. I went from Fort Logan, Colorado, to Fort Riley, Kansas, where I was trained, intensive training in trench warfare.
By the time America started fighting, France was weary from waging war for more than 3 years, all of it on its own soil. The massive casualties on their side led the French to label their battered heroes as the Lost Generation. Buckle says they and their British allies were deadlocked against a persistent enemy, and both countries were very happy to see the Yanks arrive.
When I arrived in Europe, I felt that it was a very severe situation. We were welcomed in Britain, we were welcomed in France, but it was a serious situation. They were happy to see the Americans, both the British and the French. The feeling was that here was a relief to have some younger people coming in to help.
Of course, we now know the entrance of U.S. forces made a decisive difference towards the Allied victory. Buckles gives much of the credit to the strong leadership of General John Pershing.
He was the leader, no question about it, in every way. It was reflected in the men. Realized that he was a tough character, yes.
Finally, at the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, the guns fell silent, the armistice took effect, and the killing finally stopped.
It seemed to be a relief to everybody. I didn't find it as people were so jubilant. It was more of a relief to them that the war had ended.
For Mr. Buckles and other World War I veterans, it was exceedingly difficult to see the peace following the war violated just 2 decades later. For Frank Buckles, World War II would be excruciating, even though he was no longer in uniform. By the late 1930s, he was working for a steamship company, and the outbreak of war in Europe meant shifting many of the shipping routes away to the Far East, including the Philippines, where the company already did plenty of business. But when Japanese forces went on the rampage in the Philippines, Mr. Buckles could not escape the brutality.
I was living in Manila when the World War II started. When the Japanese invaded the Philippines, I was in a prison camp, Santo Tomas, for 1 year and 2 years more in Los Baños. I was 3.5 years in Japanese prison camps. I'm one of the few who survived.
3.5 years in the horror of Japanese prison camps. So how did Frank Buckles emerge as one of the few fortunate survivors?
Physical condition. A determination to live, keeping myself in good shape as possible, as much as possible.
After being rescued from the prison camp, Buckles returned to the United States, got married, and raised a family. And in the mid-1950s, he purchased a 330-acre farm that still keeps him busy today. But of course, he's had plenty of time for reflection. Given all the amazing advancements in all areas of life since his birth, he really can't put his finger on the most significant area of progress that he's seen in his many years, but he says it's easy to narrow the list at least a little bit.
But it isn't the television.
There's also been plenty of correspondence. Buckle says the letters from current soldiers show the same patriotism, devotion to duty, and belief in the rightness of their cause that he felt 90 years ago when he went off to war. In the end, Buckles remains very proud of his service and the service of others in his generation to this country in World War I. The lingering regret, however, is that the peace following the war failed to last.
Well, there was a feeling that that was the war to end all wars, hoping that their problems could be settled some other way. I think that most of the veterans of World War I felt quite disturbed when there was another war, when they became involved in another war.
Frank Buckles is among the last of the World War I generation, but his humble dignity and plain-spoken friendliness serve as a reminder of the great Americans who did so much to build this nation, and of those throughout our history who answered the call and served this nation in uniform during its hour of need. Spending Memorial Day with him was truly an honor.
Thanks to Greg Corumbus, and special thanks to World War I veteran Frank Buckles for sharing some of his memories. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America, in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.